morning, United States versus Almazane. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right. Mr. Klein.
May it please the court. My name is John Klein, and I represent Mr. Alashi, who is one of the appellants, and I'm also prepared to argue the common issues that appear in Mr. Alashi's brief. It's a given in this country that persons charged with crimes have a right to confront their accusers. And the starting point for confrontation is to know who the accusers are, to know their names. And in two respects in this case, the district court denied the appellants, including Mr. Alashi, that right. The first respect had to do with the two anonymous witnesses. They were known to us, as Avi and as Major Lior. The defense, neither the defendants themselves nor the defense counsel, ever knew the names of those two witnesses. They were, in the words of Judge Dalzell in the Fuentes case, they were phantoms to us. Avi put it very succinctly when he was being cross-examined. He said, "You cannot research me," and in fact, we could not. The second respect in which we dealt with anonymous accusers involved the hearsay. This case, the district court in this case, admitted a massive quantity of hearsay. That hearsay, of course, presented all of the usual hearsay dangers. The declarant might have been lying, the declarant might have been mistaken, the declarant's perception might have been faulty, the declarant might have been misunderstood. But in the ordinary circumstance where hearsay is admitted, there's at least the possibility of looking into the declarant. Rule 806, for example, of the Federal Rules of Evidence permits evidence to be brought forward impeaching a declarant. There's always the possibility of calling the declarant to testify if you know who he is or she is and if that person is still alive. In this case, a great amount of the hearsay that was admitted, and I'll get into it in more detail in a little bit, involved anonymous declarants, hearsay documents with declarants whose identity no one knew. And that evidence came in, and of course, in that instance, we were unable to in any way effectively challenge the statements of the declarants, to impeach the declarants, to exercise the rights under Rule 806. These two forms of anonymous evidence, the anonymous witnesses and the hearsay involving anonymous declarants, went directly to the key issues in this case. The key issues in this case were whether these zakat committees on the West Bank, through which HLF gave charity to children and to schools and to others, whether they were acting for or on behalf of Hamas, which is a designated terrorist organization. And the second key issue related to the first was whether the defendants knew that and whether they acted willfully. And these two forms of anonymous evidence went directly to those two issues. And I want to say at the beginning that those issues were hotly contested. The zakat committees were not listed on the list of terrorist organizations. U.S. government entities gave charity through some of those zakat committees. In fact, they did it even after Holy Land was shut down and even to some extent after the indictment was first returned in this case. Ed Abington, who was a witness for the defense, he was the U.S. consul general in Jerusalem during a good part of the time involved here. He testified for the defense. He was the equivalent of the ambassador to the Palestinian Authority. He visited these zakat committees. In fact, he was the only witness in the case who had. Avi had not. Mr. Levitt, the government's other expert, had never been to a zakat committee. Mr. Abington had in his capacity as consul general. And he, in addition to visiting the zakat committees, of course, he received briefings about them. He testified under oath for the defense that he never understood these zakat committees to be connected in any way to Hamas. The evidence was substantial that there was not a connection between the zakat committees and Hamas. These were hotly contested issues. They produced a hung jury and acquittals in the first trial. In fact, Mr. Abdul Qadir was acquitted on all counts until one juror changed her mind while being polled. The other defendants were acquitted or there was a hung jury. So these were hotly contested issues, and the anonymous evidence went directly to the key issues. I'd like to turn to and talk in more detail about Avi and Major Lior, the two anonymous witnesses. And I want to focus particularly on Avi, because he was a critical witness in this case. Avi was the expert for the government who came in and tied their narrative together. It was Avi who took these disparate pieces of evidence that the government had introduced, some improperly, we argue, and wove them into a compelling story for the jury, ending with his opinion that each of the Zakat committees that were at issue in the indictment, each of these West Bank Zakat committees, was controlled by Hamas or part of Hamas. Avi is the one who put all that together, who opined that certain members of the boards of these Zakat committees were Hamas, opined that because of the positions they held on the board, they could dominate the committees, opined that in light of other circumstances that he appeared to have put together just for purposes of this case, these Zakat committees were part of Hamas. So Avi was a critical, critical witness in this case, and his credibility was essential in this case. Now, to start with first principles here, the Supreme Court said in Smith, said in Alford, that the witness's name is, as the Supreme Court put it, the starting point for determining a witness's credibility, for bringing out the truth. And the reason it's the starting point is that, again, paraphrasing Smith, it is the opening to in-court examination, avenues of in-court examination, and out-of-court investigation. And, of course, here, particularly with Avi, it was the out-of-court investigation that we were never able to do. Bearing in mind, of course, that Avi is an expert, and it is a tradition in this country, it's enshrined in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, for example, that experts are subjected to particularly close scrutiny because of the weight that their testimony carries.
Avi, on the other hand, was clearly a representative of the Israeli government. And the record, of course, is perfectly clear on the level of enmity between the Israeli government on the one hand and the Palestinian interests, various interests, on the other. So his bona fides were, his potential bias was clear from the outset.
Your Honor, I agree that in that sort of generalized respect,
where he was coming from,
I agree, it was. What we were unable to explore was beyond that sort of generalized bias resulting from his position as part of the Israeli security apparatus. And of course, I might add, he went out of his way to defuse that line of attack by arguing that because of his responsibility in turning away and deterring terrorist attacks, it was extremely important for him to be objective in his work, in his assessment. So he did his best to sort of defuse or turn aside that generalized attack on his bias. What we weren't able to do was make the more particularized challenge to his credibility that most experts, all experts except Avi, as far as I know, are subjected to. We weren't able to, for example, to find out what his reputation in his community was for truth. We weren't able to explore his credentials. He claimed to have graduated from law school, to have participated in certain cases, to have done various things in his professional life before he joined the Israeli security agency. If those things turned out...
And that also, those points were also made repeatedly.
I'm sorry?
Those points that you're making right now were also made repeatedly to the jury. We don't know anything about this person. We have no idea that he is what he claims to be.
We were able to make that point to the jury. Of course, one could do that with any anonymous witness. But there were two problems with that. One is, of course, it doesn't really tell you anything, because the jury, of course, is instructed not to speculate, to rely solely on what's in evidence. And they don't know. There's a big difference between saying, for example, we don't know anything about Avi, and saying, being able to show the jury that, for example, he had falsified his credential or he had a poor reputation in his community for veracity. That's a big difference. Also, we paid a price, as Your Honor may have noticed, for eliciting the fact that we didn't know who he was, which is that on redirect, the government was permitted to elicit that the reason his name was kept secret was because of fears of violence directed toward members of the Israeli security agency. So by making the only point we could make, hamstrung as we were, we received a volley back in the form of more of this violence evidence that was, of course, unconnected to the defendants in any way. So you're right, Your Honor. We were able to say he's a member of the Israeli Security Agency. We were able to say we don't know anything more about him. But we were not able to launch the more focused, particularized attack that every other witness, every other expert witness particularly, has to endure. And I think in our reply brief, we cited just a sample of cases, five or six cases, where experts have been destroyed. Their credibility has been destroyed because they have been investigated and particular falsehoods in their credentials or distortions in their backgrounds have been uncovered. We couldn't do that here. And, of course, I can't stand here and say what we would have found if we'd been able to. That's impossible, and Smith doesn't require us to shoulder that burden. Alston, this court's opinion in Alston says the same thing, that the defense, of course, cannot be required to identify the facts it would have discovered had it known the name. I can't do that. But what we would have done for certain is launch that kind of particularized investigation that every other expert who testifies in any court in this country, even in the most trivial civil case, has to undergo. And I want to make another point about Avi. Even if Avi were the only expert in the world on this subject, the district court's approach would not be permissible. It would not be permissible to entirely withhold his name from the defense. Some sort of balancing, some sort of accommodation along the lines of the Seelis case from the D.C. Circuit, the Fuentes case from the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, was essential and was required by the Constitution. But we weren't even at that point. That's one of the things that is particularly astonishing about this case. The government had a second expert who was noticed, who was prepared, whose name we knew, who we could investigate thoroughly, who was going to cover exactly the same topics as Avi, and that was Jonathan Feigl, or Feigl, who was a former Israeli military officer. His name was disclosed, and he could have testified to these same things. There was no indication that he wasn't available. The government, with the district court's blessing, made a tactical choice to call the expert we couldn't research rather than the expert we could research. And that was wrong. It would have been wrong even if Avi had been the only expert, but he wasn't.
Now, what is your response to the argument that, and I recognize that Avi was a very powerful witness, but there's also other evidence in this record that covers a good deal of what it is he said. I mean, for example, Dr. Levitt covered some of it, and there were others that covered it as well. So the question would be, to what degree is this harmless?
Well, and let me start with the standard, Your Honor, and then talk about those other witnesses. The standard, of course, is the Delaware versus Van Arsdal standard, which is you have to assume that the cross would have had its full effect and then ask whether the error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And if you take that approach, I don't think you can say that the denial of Avi's name to us was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And here's why. Dr. Levitt didn't testify that these Zakat committees were controlled by or part of Hamas. That wasn't his thing at all. He was there to describe the background of Hamas, to describe the various wings of Hamas, to talk about its funding structure in a somewhat generalized way that did not go to these particular Zakat committees. And there wasn't really any dispute about most of what Dr. Levitt said. The question was, were these particular Zakat committees acting for on behalf of Hamas, and did the defendants know it? Dr. Levitt didn't really cover any of that. The government did have bits and pieces of evidence. For example, El Barase 22, which is one of those anonymous hearsay exhibits that I will talk about in a minute, that suggested, that intimated, that at some point in time, most of it back in the early 90s, these Zakat committees may have been viewed as, in some respect, controlled by us or ours. But it was ambiguous. I mean, it was a tough case to make for the government. What Avi did, and he did it well, was to come into court, take all these disparate bits of information, the Philadelphia meeting and Exhibit 22 from the El Barase search and the Palestinian Exhibit number 2, which was also improperly admitted in our view, and weave all that together, coupled with a big dose of Avi opinion that these particular, the people who were on the boards of these Zakat committees were known to be Hamas. That was his opinion, which he would occasionally support, but sometimes not. And that the combination of factors that he pulled together, including such things as the funding sources, who was on the board, when they were started, he had a whole series of factors that, in his opinion, with all the weight of an Israeli security agency expert, those were controlled by Hamas. And his direct was, it was clear and succinct, and he essentially wove that all together into a nice, neat package for the government. And I don't believe under any circumstances that could be considered harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Let me turn, if I'm happy to answer more questions about Avi, but I wanted to turn to the hearsay documents for a little bit, and to Mr. Shrabaji. There are three categories of hearsay that I'd like to talk about, and I want to start with the Palestinian Authority documents. And in particular, I want to talk about Palestinian Authority Exhibit 2. There were three altogether. There was 2, 8, and 9. 8 and 9 dealt solely with the Ramallah Zakat Committee. 2 was more general.
Palestine, 9 was Ramallah?
Both 8 and 9, Your Honor, were Ramallah.
And those were taken from the headquarters of the Palestinian Authority?
They were, according to the anonymous Major Lior. And so let me set the stage. The reason I want to focus...
And 2 was taken from where?
From the same place, Your Honor.
All 3 were taken from Ramallah?
From Ramallah, from the Fatah or Palestinian Authority headquarters in Ramallah. And the reason 2 is so important is that it specifically identifies the Holy Land Fund as a funding source for Hamas. And that was a critical piece of evidence. Judge Fish, in the first trial, would not let it in under Rule 807 or the other two documents. Judge Solis, in this trial, did let it in.
Now, you agree that Fatah and Hamas were in antagonizing positions with each other?
Yes. There's no dispute about that.
Okay.
Here is the foundational evidence for all three of these exhibits, although I'm focusing on 2. Major Lior, of course, was an anonymous witness. He didn't personally seize any of these documents. They were seized, apparently, according to his testimony, by soldiers under his command, who were also nameless, who found these documents somewhere, we don't know where, in the Ramallah headquarters of the Palestinian Authority and or Fatah. Same thing, I think, in essence. So we know nothing about the provenance of these documents other than through the hearsay witness testimony of an anonymous witness that they were found in the Fatah headquarters. The document itself, Palestinian Exhibit 2, has an illegible signature, so we don't know who the declarant was. It does not have any sort of letterhead on it. Now, Judge Solis, somewhat inexplicably, to me at least, found the fact that 2 of these documents, 8 and 9, had letterheads as probative of their truthfulness. Exhibit 2 didn't even have a letterhead on it. And so it's an anonymous declarant. It has no letterhead, no date. And there's a second level of hearsay, which has never really been addressed, although we certainly raised it below, which is that the document relies upon unnamed, so again, anonymous, Western sources, Israeli sources, Western security sources, I forget all the different attributes. But in essence, all the information in that document appears to come from other unnamed sources. So we have a document whose provenance is largely unknown, an anonymous declarant relying on anonymous sources, and that document somehow gets into evidence in a federal criminal case.
Now, I have seen some of these documents, and which one are you talking about? I mean, I know you say it's 2, but I don't remember them in terms of 2.
Do you want me to display
it
to Your Honor?
Yeah, let me see.
Should I hand it up, or
let me
may
see.
I step forward?
Yeah, let me just see. I've seen these things before. Oh, this one is the one. All right.
And the translation is several pages in.
Okay. All right. So it's not the one I was thinking. Sorry. Didn't mean to get you off course.
But this document came in, of course, it doesn't fall within any of the usual hearsay exceptions. So it came in under the catch-all exception, which this court has made clear in numerous cases, including Phillips, which we've cited, that there have to be that the proponent of the document has a particularly heavy burden under Rule 807, the catch-all exception to the hearsay rule. The proponent has a heavy burden to show indicia of trustworthiness. The proponent has to show that the declarant in the document was particularly likely to be telling the truth. For this document and for all of these Palestinian Authority documents, first of all, there was no such finding made, but there was no basis to make that finding either. Nor was there any finding made or basis to make the finding for the other requirements of Rule 807. There was, of course, no notice given, which Rule 807 requires, that the name and address of the declarant be provided. I'm just talking about the first level of hearsay. That's the declarant, the person who actually wrote this document, whoever that was. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Yeah, Mr. Klein, the argument, it seems to me, is that it was in the hands of Fatah, and that this was an organization that is not friendly to Hamas. Assuming that it was from Ramallah, and that's why I asked you about Ramallah.
Yes.
Because that's the headquarters. And at least it there's an implication there that at least Fatah may have found these documents important. Whether they're hearsay or not, these documents have a certain amount of credence, at least with respect to someone who wanted to know what the opposite side was doing. And, I mean, it's the nature of the game. This isn't, we're talking about something a little bit different. Once you start talking about these aspects in Israel and in Palestine, you're talking about something a little bit different from, quote, a regular criminal case, drug conspiracy, for instance. How do you address that aspect of it?
Let me say a couple of things in response, Your Honor. I appreciate the question. First of all, this case, of course, did have aspects that were unusual that we haven't encountered in other cases. But that doesn't mean that the rules should apply to these defendants differently, that they should be relaxed, that the evidentiary requirements and the constitutional requirements should be relaxed just so these defendants can be prosecuted. That's the first thing I want to say. The second thing is, Your Honor, that the fact that these documents appear to have been created by Fatah. We don't know that, of course. They were found in the Fatah headquarters. We don't know, particularly Palestinian Exhibit 2, we don't know that it was created by Fatah, but let's assume for a minute.
Well, it may not have been.
But let's assume for a minute that it was, because I think...
No, let's assume that it could be both Fatah created or someone else created it, but in their... In other words, and this is to me, this is important. Mm-hmm. It's in the headquarters of the Palestinian Authority. There is a military operation. I presume that is correct under the record, and these documents are taken.
Correct.
Okay. And basically, that's what we have before us.
That's what we have.
And then the question then becomes, it seems to me, to what extent does Fatah, whether they created the documents, whether there's any analysis by them or not, or somebody else, I don't know.
Sure.
The possession of these documents in and of themselves become important, at least for admissibility purposes. And then, of course, you have the weight that can be, you can be attacked, just like you say. There's anonymous sources, all these other things.
I don't think the fact that they were found with Fatah provides the kind of guarantees of trustworthiness that Rule 807 requires. And here's why. These were found apparently in the possession of an intelligence organization. Intelligence organizations collect all kinds of information. They collect rumor. They collect speculation. They gather information of all kinds. And so I don't think, let's bring it home. Let's say this was seized by from the CIA headquarters. We wouldn't say that simply because it was seized from the CIA headquarters that even the first level of hearsay had particularized guarantees of trustworthiness. What I think we would say is that the CIA deemed it significant in some way.
And that's a good point, because is this hearsay?
Yes.
Well, just a minute. There is a probative value for the information itself, whether it's true or not. Now, I presume all these documents were translated and you were able to look at these documents one way or another. But address that part of it.
Yeah, yeah. I get your point.
I get your point.
And I could imagine the government coming into court and saying, Your Honor, we don't want to introduce these documents for their truth. We want to introduce them simply for the, whatever probative value it has that this document was found at Fatah headquarters. Now, in that instance, we would argue, okay, it's not hearsay, but Rule 403 keeps it out because there is no probative value to speak of this document simply being found at the headquarters of Fatah, and there's a lot of prejudice.
Now, if we add on Avi's testimony, assume that he is proven to be an expert and the jury accepted, let's just assume that at this time, is that enough? Do you see the next part of the building block?
I do see the next part. If you can just let me have 1 second
sure,
to
no
finish
problem.
My thought on the other thing. This document came in for its truth. It did not come in simply for whatever probative value the fact of it having been found at headquarters might have. It came in for its truth without any limiting instruction at all. Had it been given to Avi as a possible basis for his expert testimony, of course experts can rely on hearsay under
sure.
some circumstances, then the question would be, assuming it's the proper kind of material for an expert to rely on, does it come into to evidence at all? And that's a question under Rule 703, where the probative versus prejudicial is flipped. The government would have to show that the probative value substantially outweighed the unfair prejudice. I think we'd have a very strong argument on keeping this document out. Avi might base his testimony in part on it, but we'd be able to keep the document out. But even if it did come in over our Rule 703 objection, it would come in with a limiting instruction that it was only admitted to show a basis for Avi's testimony, not that it was being offered, as it was in this case, admitted for its truth and argued by the government for its truth in closing argument.
Well, I happen to think that, just myself, that your arguments about Rule 807 are powerful. I mean, I think there's a real question about these documents having about their admissibility. The problem is that there's a whole lot of other evidence in this record, and the question really comes down to harmless. I mean, I think the 807 argument is an extremely good argument with respect to counsel for the government.
And so let me address harmless error just for a moment. I mean, one of the things to keep in mind here is that we have a cumulative harmless error issue, which I think in this case has particular significance, because this was a case that, in my view, really went off the tracks. It really went off the tracks. Whether you're looking at the Rule 403 evidence, whether you're looking at the lay witness testimony, McBrien testimony, and the Simon testimony about how providing support to Hamas might provoke another 9/11 style attack on the U.S. And I mean, it really went off the tracks. And I don't think you can take each of these errors, and there were many of them in this record, in isolation and say, well, if everything else had been the same and just this one piece of evidence was taken out, this would be harmless. I happen to think that many of these errors, standing alone, are harmful. And I think Palestinian Exhibit 2 is an example of that. But I also think that it's very important to look at this record as a whole and to look at this 403 evidence that came in that never, ever should have come in, to look at the hearsay documents that came in, to look at the anonymous expert, to look at the opinion testimony. I mean, it is like a textbook on evidentiary error, this case. And if you look at that entire picture, I think you come away with the clear conviction that this was a patently unfair trial, in a close case. It's a close case, you know, because look at the first trial, where some of these same errors occurred, and yet the jury was unable to convict. I would say, absent those errors in the first trial, this would have been an across-the-board acquittal. Instead, because of the errors, we had a hung jury. Now we move to the second trial, and a series of things happened in the second trial that didn't happen in the first. You had Shorbaji's testimony. You had these Palestinian Authority documents. You had the McBrien testimony. You had Simon's testimony. I mean, the government, I think, after the first trial, decided to go all in here, put it all in and worry about the appeal later. And the district judge in that kind of, I think that's what happened, Your Honor. And I think the district judge in that kind of situation has to have a firm hand, has to really keep the government under control, because there was no self-restraint here. And the district judge didn't do that in this case. That's why I think you have to look at all these errors together. But to talk just about Palestinian Authority document number 2 by itself for a moment, it was, first of all, it was one of the differences between the first and second trials, which I think gives it a sort of special status. Judge Fish kept it out. Judge Solis let it in. The first jury hung or acquitted. The second jury convicted. The second point is that both Agent Burns, who was the government's sort of summary and lay opinion witness, and Avi relied on the Palestinian Authority documents in their testimony. I think Agent Burns may have even read it to the jury. Certainly Avi relied upon it. When former Consul General Abington testified, the government cross-examined him with the Palestinian Authority documents. And then the government emphasized them in closing argument. And referring specifically to government to Palestinian Authority Exhibit 2, the government said, talking about that document, there is another government, meaning the Palestinian Authority, that identified HLF as part of Hamas. So now we have not just the U.S. government, now we have this other government also making that finding. And, of course, if you look at that document and you look at that closing argument, that's just outrageous. To say, taking Palestinian Exhibit 2, which says, based on an anonymous declarant relying on anonymous sources, saying that HLF is part of the funding source for Hamas, to have that document come in for its truth and have the government argue in closing, this shows that another government has found HLF to be part of Hamas, it is just beyond the pale.
How about the Philadelphia meeting and the documents that were seized from, I guess, the houses of El-Barassi and Ashkar?
And Ashkar. Well, the Philadelphia meeting, we came into evidence. I would say it is...
In other words, that's a declaration of the party members in this particular... the people that were mm-hmm. there. And didn't that substantiate what was in the documents that were seized in Ramallah?
I would say that the Philadelphia meeting was October 93, so it's mm-hmm. about 18 months before Hamas is designated. And I would say that there are things in that meeting, which went on and on, for both sides to draw on. Mm-hmm. The government looks at portions that talk about, you know the parts that they focus sure. on. We have Mr. Abu Bakr, who of the HLF people did most of the talking. He's saying we have to abide by the law, we can't favor any party, we have to be legal. And so there are things in that Philadelphia meeting for both sides to draw on. Now, the El-Barassi and Ashgar documents are also hearsay and should not have been admitted for the reasons that we outlined. To begin with, there's the whole issue of the lawful joint venture variant of the co-conspirator exception. I know Your Honor touched on that in your opinion in the previous HLF case. Mm-hmm. But we contend and argue at length that that's just an illegitimate outgrowth of the co-conspirator exception. And there's a there's a powerful law review article that we cite, which I heartily commend to the court. But even if you say that the lawful joint venture variant is properly part of the co-conspirator exception, there was not any evidence here, and particularly not any evidence independent of those El-Barassi and Ashgar documents themselves, that the declarants, many of whom were unknown, many of whom were nameless, and, for example, Mr. Elashi, just to take my client, were engaged together in a lawful joint venture. We don't know who those declarants even were. We can't identify them. And so take El-Barassi 22, for example, which is one of the ones the government focused on. What independent evidence is there that unknown declarant, whoever he was in that handwritten document dated 1991, was engaged in a lawful joint venture with Ghassan Alashi, who's not mentioned in the document, who's not a recipient of the document, who, as far as the record shows, never saw the document. What independent evidence is there? And I could say that, make that same point about all those other El Barassi and Ashgar documents, many of which had anonymous declarants, people who are ciphers, who are phantoms to the defense. I see that my time is up.
Well,
I have
5 minutes.
Well,
you saved some time for rebuttal.
Yes, I did, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Rattel, I probably didn't get it right. Sorry.
It's okay, Your Honor. It's been happening since kindergarten. Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Joshua Dreitel. I represent Mohammed El-Mazain, and I'm going to be discussing an issue that's relevant only to Mr. El-Mazain, which is the collateral estoppel issue. At the first trial, Mr. El-Mazain was acquitted of 31 of 32 counts. The one deadlock count was count one, a conspiracy to provide material support. He was acquitted of nine substantive counts related to that conspiracy, a mirror conspiracy to violate IEPA, and the substantive counts related to the IEPA conspiracy, and then the money laundering conspiracy that was tied to the IEPA. The court's decision below denying Mr. El-Mazain's motion for dismissal based on collateral estoppel was based on two fundamentally and fatally flawed premises. The first was this court's initial decision in Yeager, which allowed reference to the deadlock count as a means for guidance into the collateral estoppel issue. The Supreme Court reversed that, and the government acknowledges that that can no longer be the basis for the for denying the collateral estoppel motion. But the second part, which the government still adheres to, is a misunderstanding of the inquiry that's required and involved in a collateral estoppel claim. And the focus by the district court was on really a traditional double jeopardy analysis, which is to focus on legal elements of the two offenses to see whether they are distinct, when collateral estoppel is a factual analysis about the elements and what is used to prove elements in cases. And that is where the district court erred, in particular in that regard. And even taking it at face value, even if you use the analysis that the district court used, which is to look at the elements, they are the notion that they are different between count 1 and count 11, the two conspiracies, one being the deadlock count, 11 being an acquittal, in addition to all the substantive counts that were acquittals. But willfully element that the district court said was present in count 11 but not in count 1, that's an illusory distinction, because charged as a conspiracy, the court charged the jury in the first trial and the second trial that the conspiracy required willfully, so it incorporated regardless of the nature of the object.
That was in the generalized conspiracy charge.
But they were both
distinguished from the specific conspiracy charge that related to number one.
But the jury would still have to find willfully for 1 or 11 because they're both conspiracies. So they still would have to find willfully as to both, regardless of the elements of the object of conspiracy. So the willfully appears in both conspiracies. So if the jury would have had to find willfully, but it's still, in essence, not the correct analysis to look at it that way, because the court has to look at the facts that were used, and the facts are indistinguishable. The case was tried indistinguishably. The government has never, to this day, in its brief and its arguments below, in the way it tried the case, ever distinguished between these sets of offenses.
I thought that the government's brief on this point was very persuasive, and that is that it makes the argument that your client took the position that he didn't intend to violate the law, that he didn't that it went right to the willfulness.
But it was much more than that, Your Honor. It was much more than that.
That's the key. I mean,
but it was also that the Zakat committees were not related to Hamas. And the way the government tried the case, and there was never a discussion of elements to be different. We tried the case that we did not, and the willfully part is part of both conspiracies. So it's still the same. The willfully goes to the whole case. And the way the government tried the case, they never distinguished. You can read the government summation. They never talk about elements. They never distinguish any of the counts. They never distinguish the IEPA from the material support. It's all the same. And if you look at the materials that the Supreme Court and this Court in Yeager as well identified as to how you evaluate a collateral estoppel claim. You're looking at the indictment. The indictment incorporates within count 11 everything from count 1. It's the same conspiracy. The overt acts are the same institutions. The organization, Hamas, is the same. Everything is the same. The co-conspirators, there's no distinction among the conspiracies on the substantive counts as to what, as to who the co-conspirators are. There's no distinction with respect to the offenses. They really have the same, it's required the same thing. You have to give something of value, in this case the same thing, money, to organizations that are designated.
Assuming that you're correct, it seems to me that cuts against you, because by necessity, if they found for your client in the conspiracy count 11, by necessity, they would have to have found count 1, because what you're saying is that it is exactly the same. And therefore, by necessity, it would have to be something else. And, of course, the government says it's this distinction between knowing and willful.
But, Your Honor, but no, go but ahead that repeats this, that repeats the error in Yeager, which is to look at the deadlock count for guidance
as to what the jury did.
It looks the deadlock count.
You look at the count that was found innocent, the 11. In other words, they proved willful. They proved all the other elements of 11. Now, assuming that's the case, and you then put it, you superimpose it on one, those elements on one, or the facts on one, the only element that still was not necessarily found is the knowing willful distinction.
No, but they didn't prove that. They didn't prove it at all. He was acquitted of all those charges.
No, Mr. And what I'm suggesting is, if there was an element in 11 that they found that necessarily determines one, okay, they would have acquitted him.
But that's looking at the deadlock count.
Yeah.
That's looking at the deadlock count again. And
let's go back, please, because I want to make sure that this conceptually I'm correct on this. If you found, let's say element C, and element C is correct. I mean, it's contained in both 1 and 11, and the jury found not guilty element C, then by necessity they would have to have found element C not guilty on count 1.
And they may have, Your Honor, but you see, the problem is that reverses what collateral estoppel is about, which is collateral estoppel is not double jeopardy analysis where everything has to be the same.
No.
In collateral estoppel, only one element has to be the same.
Yeah,
so any one element that the jury necessarily found against the government, which means all the other elements, even including assuming just for argument that the willfully is distinct, which it's not, but even assuming it is, you must look at it factually, not as a question of element versus element, but fact versus fact. And it's one element has to be the same, not all the elements. And all the elements that the jury found knowing and all the other elements that they found in 11 against the government, it necessarily found against the government with respect to count 1.
That's what
collateral estoppel is, and it's not the reverse.
But what I'm suggesting to you is the Supreme Court in Yeager found that dismiss counts like 11, not guilty counts, like 11, can be used in the collateral stop analysis.
But exactly to show that the jury found against the government on all those elements, some of which are incorporated in one. And all you need is one element, not all elements. It doesn't have to be congruence. That's a double jeopardy analysis as to legal elements. If I may finish, Your Honor, my answer?
Yeah.
And now?
Sure.
Yes. But that's... Collateral estoppel only requires that one element factually be found against the government in those acquitted counts, and you have all the elements found against the government in every count, including substantive counts of IEPA and material support. Material support, substantive counts, with every overt act mirrored in those 8, 9 substantive counts 2 through 10, still acquitted. So thank you very much.
We've got it. Thank you. Now, I'm not going to even try. Sorry.
Good morning, Your Honor. Ranjana Natarajan. May it please the Court. I'm here on behalf of Appellant Holy Land Foundation, or HLF. The trial of HLF in absentia and without counsel undoubtedly violated the corporation's right to assistance of counsel.
Let's talk about, I know that this probably may not be your order of battle, so to speak, but let's talk about this appeal. I have a great question here about whether this appeal is proper. And I think it's a very different inquiry than the inquiry about the trial. In the case of the appeal, you have the principles, so to speak, of the Holy Land Foundation. They're all still alive and well, maybe not as well as they were before, but they're still around. And they've said nothing. They're just quiet. But they're in existence. The Holy Land Foundation has not authorized an appeal. Now, the Holy Land Foundation doesn't have to appeal. We know that a criminal defendant can just say, I've had as much of the U.S. justice system as I want. I'm not appealing. Forget it. And that's a decision that we respect. And I don't see how, I don't know that the inquiry would be at all the same with respect to a trial. I think it would be a very different inquiry. But there's been no authorization of an appeal here. We have had no indication from the Holy Land Foundation that they wanted to appeal. And as far as I'm concerned, tentatively, that means that this appeal has to be dismissed.
Let me answer that in two ways, Your Honor. I understand the court's concern about this issue. Like the court, we believe that the general case requires an authorization by the client for any attorney step, including, obviously, a criminal appeal. In this case, the facts of the record clearly show that there were two decision makers for Holy Land Foundation subsequent to the indictment in this case, generally speaking, perhaps even just one, which was Mr. Elashi. And I think the trial record is important because it sheds light on the issue for the appeal, so if I may, I'll sort of route back around to the answer. As of 2007, when Mr. Elashi, on advice of counsel, said, I can't act on behalf of HLF anymore, then there seemed to be at least nobody who could act on behalf of HLF. However, the district court could have held an inquiry to determine whether at that point there was a third-party trustee who could be appointed on behalf of HLF in order to guard its assets for purposes of the forfeiture in this case and to try the case and obtain counsel, or whether there were disinterested directors of the board, which there were, the record shows. These co-defendants were not the only directors or officers or members of the board at the time that Holy Land was shut down. Whether those individuals, the disinterested board members, could obtain counsel, or whether, you know, if all else was impossible, whether the state of California, through the Attorney General, wanted to step in to protect these assets. None of those facts have changed to this day. In other words, what we suggested to the court below was the same thing for purposes of appeal, which is we suggested going forward, it makes sense to appoint a trustee, which the court had the inherent power to do, to make sure that that person could direct the representation for purposes of appeal. Now, as a factual matter, none of the co-defendants who were the previous decision makers for Holy Land indicated that they did not want to appeal or that they did not want, on behalf of HLF, or that HLF did not want to appeal. And neither did any of the former disinterested board members speak up and say, wait a minute, HLF should not be appealing. What we have is a conundrum because it's a very unique circumstance. Once the organization was shut down, there's an OFAC regulation in place that says nobody is authorized to transact business on behalf of HLF except without OFAC permission.
Well, but they could have gone and gotten it. Certainly OFAC had authorized prior when people had gone to them and asked for permission, they'd certainly done it.
And in fact, they were proceeding from 2004 to 2007, from the time of indictment until the time that Mr. Elashi changed his position with respect to HLF and Friedman Boyd had to withdraw. They were proceeding under OFAC general license or specific license. But OFAC had never given a license to anybody else, and nobody else knew that they could approach. We're talking about an organization now 6 years down the road, 9 years down the road. The former board members haven't had any relationship to this organization now for several years. It's been defunct. It has not done nothing except, of course, go through this trial in name only, unrepresented by counsel. So I think it would be near impossible, especially in the absence of a district court inquiry, to require somebody, a human representative of HLF at this point, to authorize this appeal. So what we suggested to the court, and if the court feels any concern about this, I think that it would be appropriate to remand again and ask the district court to hold this hearing to inquire as to, are there any former board members, or can we just appoint a third-party trustee who can act as, if you will, the guardian of HLF for purposes of this trial? Because at least if we know that the appeal would vindicate, the appeal would address the problem underlying the trial, which was that HLF had no counsel, and if it's clear that HLF had a right to counsel, which we submit that it clearly did under decades of case law, right, on the right to counsel, then this is the only vehicle through which HLF can vindicate those rights. There is no other vehicle. And if in order to feel comfortable that HLF has authorized this appeal, we need more, then we would reiterate what we suggested to the district court. Let's hold that inquiry. Let's find out who can be the trustee for the purposes of HLF authorizing an appeal. And that doesn't seem to me to be a very difficult inquiry. It could be as simple as finding an officer of the court or an attorney who practices before the Northern District of Texas who would assume that fiduciary duty. And in fact, we had suggested a couple of names of individuals who were willing to do that to the district court.
All right. I have that argument. Sorry to have taken all your time on that.
So let me address a couple of things that I think the record clearly shows in my remaining 1 minute. I think the record is very clear that HLF had no counsel at trial, and none of the other co-defendants' counsel purported to represent HLF ever. Number two, I think the record is equally clear that as a result of that, HLF had no one to pursue its chief line of defense, which is the corporate criminal liability standard. And that's a standard that none of the other co-defendants was not relevant to their defense, and therefore none of them would have pursued.
That they acted ultra vires?
That they acted beyond the scope of their employment or not for the purpose of benefiting the corporation. That's right, Your Honor. And moreover, none of the other defendants were facing forfeiture, and therefore nobody did anything with respect to HLF's assets for the purposes of forfeiture. There doesn't need to be prejudice on this record. There doesn't need to be harmlessness error review because it's a complete denial of counsel. And case law tells us, from Glasser to Kyler to Gonzalez-Lopez, tells us that it's structural error, automatic reversal. But there is prejudice and there is harm. And the last point I want to make is there is nothing in the record that shows waiver of the right to counsel. The government concedes there's no explicit waiver, and what it says is there's implicit waiver. But waiver cannot be implicit under this court's own precedent, under Supreme Court precedent, and there's no bad faith conduct, nothing that shows any manipulation or abuse of process. They specifically got a day-long evidentiary hearing and testimony from four of the lawyers at this table. And at the end of the day, the district court concluded no bad faith, no deception. So the argument that they sowed reversible error somehow by conspiring to deprive HLF of representation just is not borne out by the record. If anything, it's the opposite that happened here.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Tiger.
Judge King, and may it please the court, I'm here for Nancy Hollander. Beginning in 2004, with the letters that appear at record excerpt page 191, Ms. Hollander attempted to resolve this issue of counsel for Holy Land. Then in March of 2007, as the government pressed on the potential conflict, it began to be discussed again. Finally, as the record shows, on the 20th of July 2007, Ms. Hollander was told to choose, and she did so. Judge Fish was invited to hold a Rule 44 colloquy or catechism at that point, but did not. And so from that moment forward, Ms. Hollander had a duty of undivided loyalty to her individual client. The record is clear that she, from the very beginning, from 2004 onward, was solicitous of Holy Land Foundation's position. Thus, on the facts here, and indeed government counsel remarked on the 20th of July at page 1014, volume 5, 8044, that perhaps Holy Land would thereafter be unrepresented. So Judge Solis's finding is completely without basis in the record. And so we turn to the question of case or controversy, which some member of the panel sent a letter about. Walker against City of Mesquite holds that when you say something about a lawyer's professional duty, like Judge Solis said, that's reviewable. And although the government hasn't filed an answer brief, I think neither they nor with respect a panel of the court would be entitled to sing the requiem for Judge Politz's opinion in Walker versus City of Mesquite.
Mr. Taggart, was there any order entered or any document that was entered as of record verifying this oral pronouncement?
Oh, yes. The oral pronouncement, it appears
so
in his opinion.
So there is a document.
Yes, there is a document. Okay. But then that brings me to an interesting point, Judge Garza. You know, we are all, to some greater or lesser extent, originalists here. And those who wrote Article 3 wrote in the shadow of Blackstone, who said that even if you just said orally something about a lawyer, like Judge Solis said about Ms. Hollander, it was actionable without proof of special damage because it was assumed to be harmful. And that is a teaching as old as Blackstone and therefore as old as Article 3 and as new as Restatement Section, oh, I think it's 587.
But what is the cause of action when a district judge makes that type of determination? Do you see what I mean? In other words, let's just say they make another determination, it's hearsay, mm-hmm. or there is a judgment as a matter of law. The court made a determination. Now, this is kind of an odd duck. I mean, it's a real odd duck.
Let me try to describe the duck, if I may, Judge Garza. This court has jurisdiction over the appeal under Section 1291.
Absolutely.
Therefore, it has jurisdiction over every aspect of the appeal and every aspect of what went on. But even if it did not, I've been a member, this is 42 years since I've been standing at a platform like this. This court has
Are
never.
Are you really that? No,
ma'am. Thank you. This court has never hesitated to exercise its supervisory power, which Judge Justice Clark mentioned in LeBoy versus Howes Leather. Judge King wrote an opinion in INRI EEOC in 709 F. Second. Judge Goldberg did in 748 F. Second, joined by Judge Barksdale. Never hesitated to exercise this supervisory power. LeBoy is 352 U.S. 249. To tell district judges, you know, you're off the rails here. You really shouldn't have done that. We had a Fifth Circuit panel some years ago in Jackson. I think Judge Reveley and I were on it, and you talked about doing just exactly that. And so this is the kind of case in which it's that kind of a duck. Now, we're hampered here by the fact the government didn't file an answer brief. Instead, they took page 25 of their Holy Land brief, they fired a shot from behind a tree at Ms. Hollander, and then Holy Land responded. But that's the story. And so the reason for that supervisory power is that you can prevent this ever happening again. You can prevent it happening again by saying, look, Judge Fish, you should have held a Rule 44 colloquy to clarify it. And also, you know, there was a lawyer in that room. There were lawyers who had a duty to see that justice was done. Those are the lawyers at that table. And this court ought to say to them that under Berger against United States, they need to step up to the plate and take that responsibility, which they have not done to this good day. And I respectfully suggest that that's the supervisory mandamus kind of approach that, you know, confers the jurisdiction. Mandamus unnecessary because we have the appeal. I hope that describes the duck adequately. I see I'm almost out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate your comment. Mr. Palmer.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. I'm Joseph Palmer from the Justice Department. I'd like to begin talking about the expert witness issue. The district judge in this case was within its discretion to protect the identities of the two Israeli witnesses who testified for the government in this case. The reason why that decision was within the court's discretion was because, first, the government's evidence established that there was a real threat to the safety of those witnesses should their identities be disclosed. And I don't think that the defendants have seriously contested the seriousness of that threat. It's clear, then, that in the circumstances when the government establishes such a threat, the district court has discretion to protect the identities of those witnesses as long as it does not materially hinder the defendant's ability to conduct an effective cross-examination. The defendants in this case were able to conduct such a cross-examination because they had substantial information regarding the professional background of where these witnesses were coming from. They also had all of the information that Avi relied on in forming his opinions about the committees. And with that material, the defendants, if you look at the actual record and the cross-examination that was conducted in this case, it was rigorous and it was effective. The defendants, first of all, were able to show to the jury and explain to the jury that they had been unable to investigate the educational background of the witness. And in the moment that the defendants describe when Avi says, "You can't research me," that was in agreement with a statement or a question from defense counsel explaining to the jury that they had been under this disability. And so the jury was able to weigh that, the possibility that there may have been exaggeration of the witness's law degree. And the district judge gave an instruction that specifically authorized to do that. The instruction stated that the jury could consider the fact that the witnesses had testified anonymously in evaluating their testimony.
Now, Mr. Klein, the problem with that is that I think Mr. Palmer, the problem with that is what Mr. Klein indicated, and that is that there was an absence of a more focused and particularized attack, which is always the case with an expert like this. How do you answer that?
Your Honor, with respect to the particular subject matter of the testimony, there wasn't any absence of any focused attack because the defendants had the benefit of all of the information that Avi relied on. And they were also able to place him in his proper setting as an intelligence officer of the Israeli government, which was the opponent of Hamas, engaged in operations against Hamas, who clearly had, in their view, an incentive to testify consistent with the interests of his government.
So in other words, this generalized admission of his status as a intelligence officer slash lawyer for the Israeli security, plus the anonymity that was part of this, that the jury could, in fact, weigh, enveloped this specific attack on perhaps other aspects of his background.
That's our view, Your Honor. Now, we wouldn't say that there was no, that it was impossible that with the benefit of the names, that there may have been some use to that investigation. Obviously, in the ordinary case, the defendants would be entitled to the name. But our position is that in these extraordinary circumstances, given the seriousness of the threat, the district court has discretion to weigh the relatively remote likelihood that such information would have been material over and above the information that they already had regarding the professional affiliation of the witnesses. The possibilities that the defendants articulated in the district court's view weren't particularly compelling, that he might have exaggerated his law degree or that he might have come from an Israeli settlement. His expertise wasn't based on his legal education, and it wasn't particularly likely that the Israeli security agency would employ as a legal advisor someone who didn't have a law degree. And so the district court can weigh the relatively remote likelihood that such material impeachment information would have been discovered against the very weighty interests on the other side and against the defendant's ability with respect to the actual subject matter of the testimony, that they were able to specifically challenge the conclusions that he actually made about the committees because they had the underlying information. They had, as Jenks material, a kind of book that he'd created summarizing his conclusions with the references to the underlying material. And they were also able, because of his professional affiliation, to place him in context before the jury. So if you look at the record, Your Honor, and you see the cross-examination that was conducted, it's not the case that the witness was able to simply say whatever he wanted to about the committees, and the defendants were helpless to say anything about that. They were able to challenge his conclusions against the underlying material, against the Jenks material, against their own investigation of the committees, against the conclusions of their own experts. There were multiple opportunities to cross-examine Avi. He testified at a Daubert hearing before the first trial, at the first trial, at the second trial, and in addition, he testified at a special hearing that the district court granted to the defendants to give them an opportunity to examine Avi regarding whether he had relied on any information that hadn't been disclosed to the defense. And the defendants were able to use those multiple opportunities to further challenge his testimony. And so given in this case the seriousness of the threat and the effectiveness of the cross-examination that actually took place, and given the fact that the court instructed the jury that they were entitled to take into account his anonymous status and that the defendants were able to point that out and that the jury could weigh it, given all of that, in light of these extraordinary circumstances, the district court is within its discretion to make the decision that it did. In analogous circumstances, the Fourth Circuit has permitted an expert witness from El Salvador to testify without disclosure of his name to the defense for basically these same reasons, that because he was affiliated with the El Salvador police and because he had testified previously and the defendants had the advantage of that prior testimony, they're able to place him in his proper setting and to conduct an effective cross-examination. In this case, where the names of the witnesses was classified, and therefore no one in Israel actually knows the true names of the witnesses in connection with their professional work, the names would have been of limited utility. They wouldn't be connected in any way to the professional work, which was the subject matter of the testimony. So that's not to say that that nothing from the personal life could possibly be relevant, but in light of the disconnect between the testimony and the inability of the defendants to articulate something more compelling than educational exaggeration or that he came from a settlement, the district court was within its discretion to balance the interests the way that it did. I'd like to say something about the obvious testimony, and the defendants take the perspective that he was the linchpin of the case, that there wasn't really any other evidence that these committees were controlled by Hamas.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is other evidence, but I'm interested in your take on that.
Let me turn to that briefly, Your Honor.
Although, admittedly, Avi obviously was a very powerful witness.
The other evidence regarding the committees, first of all, there were two reports, one from the Ashkar documents and one from the El Barase documents. One of them, from the El Barase documents, was a letter that was addressed to Shukri, the first name of the defendant, Shukri Baker, that reflected the Palestine Committee's close monitoring of these committees and enumerated the extent to which Hamas controlled them. The letter to Shukri contained within it a table that listed out the committees and identified saying these committees are ours, and identified the particular leaders who, by virtue of whom Hamas had control of these committees. Those two reports were corroborated by a similar report that was given at the Philadelphia meeting, in which Palestine Committee member Muin Shabib gave a similar report discussing the extent to which these committees are ours. Those documents show the defendant's interest in and knowledge of the Hamas-controlled status of these committees and establish the fact that that the committees were, in fact, controlled by Hamas. The letter to Shukri Baker that identified particular leaders as being members of Hamas were corroborated by other evidence that the government had establishing that those leaders were, in fact, Hamas leaders. So, for example, the government introduced an exhibit that they called the tent video. This is HLF search number 70. And in that video...
What is the video again? What word did you use? What type of video?
But they call it the tent video because it takes place in a tent.
Tent video.
And it's referred to in the government's brief. And in this tent video, the Hamas logo flashes on the screen, and different people identify themselves and explain that they're from particular ones of these committees. And so, for example, there's a man by the name of Fouad Abouzaid, who announces that he's from the Jenin Zakat Committee, corroborating the letter to Shukri Baker that states that the Jenin Zakat Committee is ours by virtue of Abouzaid. Yeah. And in addition, Abouzaid was on the list of HLF's overseas speakers. He contained in senior Hamas leader Abu Marzouk's personal address and phone book. And that kind of connection the government established with respect to a number of these leaders. And, you know, it's difficult for me to articulate all that. This was before Your Honors now, but I encourage you in your review of the record to see the numbers of these connections that the government was able to introduce. The government's other expert, Matthew Levitt, testified.
Yeah, Matthew Levitt, I've read that testimony. I've read several of these, but that one I read for sure. And there is some testimony in there, as I recall, about the committees and about Hamas control over them. It's not anywhere near as extensive as elsewhere, but it's certainly not as obvious. But
That's correct, Your Honor. It's not. It wasn't the theme of his testimony in the way that it was of obvious, but he did mention that, and in particular, he referred to two of the committees that had been implicated in providing logistical support for Hamas attacks, and so that's additional evidence.
Which ones were they? Do you recall?
I don't recall, Your Honor. I could guess.
Keep on going.
But it's cited
in his testimony.
And of course, Avi's testimony wasn't simply an expression of his beliefs about the committees. It was corroborated by piles of documents that the Israeli government obtained from the committees, Hamas material, Hamas memoranda, Hamas propaganda. All of that tended to show that the committees were, in fact, controlled by Hamas. And so all of that evidence, Your Honor, from multiple different sources, it's not the case that it was simply Avi. Established the fact that the evidence regarding these committees. As long as we're talking about evidence, if I could also come back to the multiple sources of evidence that established, the government's case was sort of bifurcated. It proved that separately that the committees were controlled by Hamas, and it also had evidence that the Holy Land Foundation was established by this Palestine committee solely for the purpose of raising funds for Hamas. And so that evidence itself was powerful proof that the committees were Hamas-controlled, because if the fact that an institution that was established for the purpose of providing financing for Hamas is contributing large sums of money to these institutions, well, there's an inference that can be drawn there that naturally those committees are controlled by Hamas, because that's what the institution was established for. Now, again, coming back to the El Barassa and the Ashkar documents, those documents show the existence and the establishment and the purpose of this of the Palestine Committee. It includes the Palestine Committee's organization chart, its bylaws, memoranda discussing the purpose and discussing their establishment of sub-organizations, including the HLF, to carry out its purpose, which is explicitly explained in those documents, to provide support for Hamas.
Now, those documents came in under an exception. How did they come in?
They came in as co-conspirator statements, Your Honor.
Okay.
And so they're unindicted co-conspirators?
What's the date of those?
Those documents predate the...
That's right. So that's...
This is the lawful... They came in under the lawful joint venture theory of the co-conspirator rule. And if I can take a little detour and just address that quickly, Your Honor. This court's cases establish that a conspiracy need not be criminal to qualify under the rule. And the defendants dismiss those cases as dicta, but I don't think that's correct. And I invite the court particularly to look at the case Sarmiento Rosso, which involved the crew of a ship importing drugs. And this court stated that there was too little evidence, too little independent evidence of the documents to have them be admitted under the, too little evidence of a criminal conspiracy to admit the documents on that basis. And so the court concluded that there was sufficient evidence, independent evidence of the documents, that the crew was engaged in this lawful joint venture of sailing the ship. And the court admitted the documents on that basis alone. And so that sounds like a holding. It was crucial to the court's decision to admit the documents. And it's the government's position that this court is bound by that determination. One point that I wanted to make briefly about the harmless error point. The defendants repeatedly refer to the first trial and the fact that there were acquittals as to the defendant Almazane and hung juries as to the rest at the first trial, and to point to the difference between the evidence that came in at the first trial and the second trial. I don't think that's proper harmless error analysis. The way to do harmless error analysis is to look at the evidence from the trial from which the convictions came. And the court isn't to look at the previous trial and to draw inferences from what happened there. And the government's position, again, is that if you look at the evidence in the record that came in that second trial that I've just been discussing, then the court will find that the evidence came in from multiple different sources, both with respect to the committees and with respect to the fact of that HLF was established for the purpose of providing funds for Hamas. And
are you going to talk about the 807 problem? And because that is troubling.
Yes, Your Honor. As long as we're talking about harmless error, let me talk about that first and then get back to the 807, because I agree with Your Honor that it's a close question under that rule. But on the harmlessness point, first, two of those documents refer to only one of the committees in the indictment, the Ramal Zakat Committee. And so those documents are clearly harmless because the jury convicted on substantive counts as to all the other committees. And so the fact that there was some cumulative evidence in addition to all the other evidence that I've talked about with respect to the Ramallah Zakat Committee, it isn't likely to be harmful. With respect to the other document, PA number 2, this is the document that there's sort of a key sentence in that document that identifies HLF as part of the Hamas financial network. That document is cumulative of all of the other evidence that, particularly coming from the Ashkar and the El Barassi documents, that HLF was established by the Palestine Committee solely with a mission and purpose to raise funds for Hamas. And, of course, that evidence was corroborated by the Philadelphia Committee, by the testimony from Sherbaji, the cooperating witness who participated with the defendants in the enterprise of collecting donations in the United States and sending them overseas to these Zakat-controlled committees. Now, the defendants don't dispute. They have a challenge as to his testimony about the committees. But the vast bulk of his testimony was about his participation with the defendants in this project. And there's no dispute that testimony was within his personal knowledge. And in particular, he testified that he attended a closed-door meeting with the number one and number two leaders of Hamas, Khalid Mishal and Marzouk, at which those leaders discussed specifically how they would support Hamas by collecting donations here and sending them to Hamas-controlled entities in the West Bank and Gaza. So
when did that meeting take place?
I think 1994, Your Honor.
Before the designation.
Before the designation.
Yeah.
Coming now to the merits of the residual exception. The purpose, the lodestar of the residual exception, is to give a court flexibility to admit documents that have the same circumstantial guarantees of trustworthiness as traditional hearsay exceptions. And these documents are reliable for the same reasons as public records are generally reliable. The Palestinian Authority, like any government, has an incentive to create accurate documents so that it can, and in particular when the documents are reporting on the rival entity, Hamas. There isn't any evidence that these documents were created for the purposes of propaganda or created for any purposes other than the internal use of the Palestinian Authority in...
But not every sheet of paper that would be found at the Palestinian Authority falls into the category of a public record of the that would fit within that hearsay exception. I mean it's just... And some of these documents are, you have no idea who they don't have any ownership attributed to them except for the fact that they were found there. Now, one of them was on a letterhead, but one of them is just absolutely devoid of any kind of identifying information.
That's right, Your Honor. So the government, it's true that the government relies heavily on the fact that they were obtained from these from the Ramallah office of the Palestinian Authority, and that the documents themselves are, they don't have, there's no reason as you look at them to think that they aren't authentic.
I want to make sure that this is correct, and it's in the record. The Ramallah headquarters is both the headquarters, the capital of the Palestinian Authority, the PLO, and Fatah, all the same probably. It makes a distinction. I mean, because one is an authority, a governmental authority. One is a party. Is a party. Now, what type of party? I'm not going to characterize it, but.
Here's my sense of the record on that point, Your Honor. I'm not sure that I think in Levitt's testimony, he does refer to the PLO, but that's a term that refers to earlier periods. The relationship between the Palestinian Authority at the time that we're discussing and Fatah, I think, is that the Fatah party essentially controlled the Palestinian Authority at that time. And I think that that's not in dispute. And because that party...
So that you can identify, I mean, the record establishes that from the record before us.
Your Honor, I don't know that off the top of my head I can cite chapter and verse on that, but I think in Levitt's testimony he does give background on the PA and Fatah and that at that time Fatah is essentially controlling the PA.
Okay.
Your Honor, on the notice point, it's true that the documents don't, especially particularly PA number 2, doesn't have a name attached to it. But the defendants had adequate notice because the government informed the defendants of its intent to introduce these documents prior to the first trial, and then at the second trial. And this court has said in a case called Evans that the notice requirement should be interpreted flexibly. And I think in the extraordinary circumstances of this case where we're relying on evidence overseas in this relatively chaotic area, this is an example of a time when it's within the district court's discretion to say these documents are they're government documents, essentially. They're reliable for the same reasons that government documents are. I'm going to credit the testimony that they were, in fact, taken from the Ramallah office of the Palestinian Authority and admit the documents on that basis. Your Honor, I'd like to turn briefly to the Elmazain double jeopardy point. It's Elmazain's burden to show that the acquittal on the Count 11 conspiracy could not reasonably have been based on a fact that was not necessary for his conviction on the Count 1 conspiracy at the second trial. There's no need to reconcile the district court's inability to reach a verdict on the count one conspiracy. So what the jury instructions may have said about the conspiracy in count one doesn't matter. All that matters is that the acquittal could reasonably have been based on the jury's determination that that Elmer Zane did not act with willful intent, that he thought that making contributions to entities that were not themselves designated was lawful.
And that was a major thrust of this trial.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in fact, the defendants maintain in the Elashi brief.
And the prior one.
The prior one is the one that counts. And it's cited in our brief that counsel for Elmer Zane quoted this willfulness instruction and explained to the jury this is important. And he referred to the underlying evidence, in particular the fact that HLF had hired this lobbyist to meet with various government officials to try to get information about which entities they could lawfully donate to. And so the jury was it was reasonable that the jury accepted Elmer Zane's defense on that point. And if it's reasonable that they did that, then those acquittals cannot have preclusive effect on a count that doesn't require a showing that Elmer Zane behaved with willful intent. And that is as simple as the collateral estoppel doctrine is in this case. There's that if he can't establish that the jury's verdict was based on that fact, and I agree with him that it's a factual analysis, but that the jury, it has to be unreasonable that the jury acquitted on the basis of that fact. And he hasn't even really attempted to make that showing.
Now, what he points out is that there was an in globo conspiracy instruction that required willfulness. And I take it that, on this trial, and also may have been on the other one, I'm not sure.
I think he's referring to the instruction at the first trial. Well, as I understand his position, he's saying that because at the first trial there was the general omnibus conspiracy instruction, not the specific conspiracy instruction that referred to the count one conspiracy. So first the government would just say, look, the specific prevails over the general. But setting that aside, he's saying that because the general instruction said that you had to find willful for any conspiracy, therefore it couldn't have been the case that the jury had in its mind this distinction between the willful intent on the one hand and the knowingly on the other. But that doesn't matter because we don't have to explain a distinction. We're not supposed to explain why the jury hung on count one. That's just not part of the analysis. All we're looking at is the acquitted counts and what facts are precluded from relitigation in a second trial and what facts are necessary for a conviction of that second trial. And in this case, the government and the district court have pointed to a fact that could reasonably have been, based on the evidence and the arguments at the trial, the basis for the jury's acquittal. And that fact, it's undisputed, is not necessary for a conviction at the second trial. Your Honor, I'd like to briefly make a point about the independent source exception, just briefly. As I read the defendant's briefs, they do not contend, they don't dispute that the subsequent warrant was actually independent of the initial seizure of the materials from the HLF offices that, assuming for the sake of argument, required a warrant and there wasn't one. So the independent source doctrine should apply, and what the defendants contend, as I understand their argument, is that the independent source doctrine can't apply because in the circumstances of this case, the materials were never returned to private hands. That principle is explicitly rejected by the Supreme Court in the Murray case. And in addition, the defendants refer to this court's decision in Grossenheider, and as I read that case, it doesn't help them. The computer that was initially seized pursuant to a tainted seizure, and then later a warrant was obtained, it also was never returned to private hands prior to the time that the warrant was obtained. And so That principle doesn't support the defendant's argument on that point.
Let me ask you about what the record shows with respect to these two events. The first event being when the OFAC came in and seized everything within the four walls of the foundation and then transported it someplace and left it there. Does it show anything about whether any, I know that was clearly a seizure, does it show anything about whether those documents were then, the documents as distinguished from the trash baskets and whatever, were read or in any way perused? I mean, is there any testimony whatsoever about what happened between the point at which they were seized and the point at which the effort was made to get a warrant? Were they just simply locked up in that building and no one went there, or what? Is there any evidence at all on that?
I'm trying to think if there's testimony, and I'm not sure the answer to that question, Your Honor, but the government's pleadings do make that argument that they were locked up in the warehouse and that the FBI didn't look at them. Certainly the affidavit that was submitted to the magistrate did not refer to anything learned from those materials that was material. It did refer in one paragraph to an inventory that just said generally, you know, there's computers and books amongst this material, that the agent had seen that inventory. But I don't think that there's anything in the record, I don't think it was disputed that, no, in fact, the FBI had gone in there and rifled through all the stuff in between that time. And I don't think there's anything to support a contention that their decision to seek the warrant was prompted by what they found there. And certainly the affidavit establishes probable cause independent of anything that even assuming that had taken place, that they would have found. In the context of this case, where it's clear that there was an investigation that had taken place over a number of years, there's no reason to think that the agents were that they lacked probable cause, and they were only able to obtain probable cause by surreptitiously going to the warehouse and
well, in fact, the argument in that connection, I think, is that. The seizure occurred in advance of receipt of a warrant. Seizure, I think, was in December, then maybe 4 months later, April, they get a warrant. And so the argument is that if there was a sufficient basis for a warrant to issue the 4 months later without any examination or review of those documents, then that whatever existed in April would have existed in December. And so the appropriate thing to do would have been to get a warrant in the first instance prior to the seizure, and that constitutes some violation. Is that one of their arguments?
That is one of their arguments, and we contend that under the special needs exception that a warrant wasn't necessary. But with the independent source doctrine, we're assuming for the sake of argument that the appropriate thing to have done would have been to get a warrant. But under the independent source doctrine, the court still does not exclude evidence as long as the subsequent warrant was an independent was obtained independent of any information that was obtained pursuant to the, assuming for the sake of argument, tainted warrant. And I think that this court doesn't need to reach the question of the special needs exception because the independent source doctrine applies so clearly in this case. Your Honor, if the court doesn't have any further questions, I'll yield the remainder of my time.
Give back some time, Mr. Gault. You're going to give back some time?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. You have any questions? Let me just hold on just 1 minute.
Oh, of course.
The Alvarez and the Ashkar search documents don't have authors manifest on the documents. That's a problem.
Your Honor, the What the documents make clear is that these are, they are formal records of the Palestine Committee. There's bylaws, there's an organization chart. The organization chart identifies the defendants as members of that committee. And so there's circumstantial evidence within the documents that they are of what they are. And it's true that the fact that that's on some of them we don't know who the declarants are has some weight, and the defendants are entitled to and did make that argument to the jury. But it certainly doesn't undermine their admissibility under the co-conspirator exception in light of all the corroborating evidence, both within the documents themselves, between the Ashkar documents and the El Barassi documents, which are mutually consistent. And in addition, the Philadelphia conference, which was explicitly described as a meeting called for by the Palestine Committee. In addition, there was evidence that the members of the Palestine Committee supervised and managed the HLF. The documents state that we're going to draw up the HLF's budget, we're going to monitor it, and the wiretap evidence reflects that. There was evidence that the head of the Palestine Committee, Marzouk, intervened in a dispute between the HLF and a rival fundraising organization run by Ashkar, and that Marzouk, in his status as the senior member of the Palestine Committee, worked that out. There was other wiretap evidence showing that another member of the Palestine Committee, Omar Ahmed, intervened in and resolved discussions regarding the defendant El Mazain's compensation for his fundraising on behalf of HLF. The Shorbaji testimony corroborated when he referred in particular to this closed-door meeting at which three of the defendants were present. The defendant, El Mazain, led the money group, this breakout session that talked about this project of raising money on behalf of Hamas and sending it to Hamas-controlled entities in the West Bank. There was also evidence of a financial relationship between the HLF and Marzouk, the head of the Palestine Committee, and personal relationships, phone records that showed that there was frequent telephone contact between the defendants and Marzouk. And so all of that evidence makes the El Barassi and the Ashkar documents credible and reliable as records of this Palestine Committee, even the examples of the ones where the declarant is unknown. One of the important documents is this El Barassi number 22, which is this letter to Shukri with the table of the committees and the extent to which those are ours. It's a letter to Shukri, and in addition to being obviously what it is monitoring what extent do we control these committees, so you can tell from the document what it is, but also it's addressed to Shukri. So the district court was entitled to credit that evidence and to admit it under the co-conspirator exception, and the defendants can argue that, hey, these documents were made before it was illegal to contribute to Hamas, and we don't know who said them, but the fact that the documents identify the HLF and the individual defendants as members of this committee that the documents are all about, I think is more than enough for them to be admissible under the co-conspirator exception.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Cowger?
Good morning. It's still morning, Your Honor.
Yeah, it is.
I'm Susan Cowger, representing the United States in this case. The government's cross appeal in the case has to do with whether the appeal of HLF is perfected, the subject that you were speaking about earlier. And I think that Your Honor is right, Judge King, that the facts surrounding the time of the appeal can be separated effectively from what happened at the trial. And we can focus on whether this appeal has been authorized and or perfected in a way that the law requires it to be. And the fact is that it has not. Nobody from HLF has authorized the appeal. That's a factual finding that Judge Solis made upon remand. Despite being given the opportunity to do so, the facts are that Ms. Natarajan contacted both Ms. Hollander and Mr. Klein before the time period for appeal, I think even before the sentencing. And Mr. Klein decided that he was not going to advise his client, or he's going to advise his client, Mr. Alashi, not to speak to Ms. Natarajan, not to authorize an appeal. For whatever reason he may have had, the fact is that the appeal was not authorized by anybody on behalf of HLF. The decision to appeal, of course, belongs to a client, not to a lawyer. It certainly does not belong to a lawyer who has had no relationship with that client before the events of filing a notice of appeal and an appearance. Ms. Natarajan filed a notice of appeal that said, this notice of appeal is filed on behalf of HLF, who is represented by the undersigned, which is, it says that's a misrepresentation. She was not representing them. And the court below found that in the interest of justice, it should appoint her to represent HLF going forward. But I'm going to get to why that is not effective. But that order appointing her is the only source from which her authority would come. There was nothing before that. And it is before that time that is the important time. As I said, the decision to appeal belongs to the client. This makes sense. As Your Honor said, a client can decide not to appeal. It is not appropriate for this court or for the district court to have decided that HLF saying nothing was equivalent to acquiescing in an appeal, because that is not a proper standard. And it may be the case that if there's an existing lawyer-client relationship, that a lawyer can say, well, I know my client and we've talked and I can infer he wants me to file an appeal. And if he later tells me that he really doesn't want to, no harm, no foul, we can withdraw the appeal or move to dismiss it. But when there's no existing, pre-existing relationship, that's an inappropriate step for a lawyer to take. It would create havoc on the dockets, and I think this case is a prime example of the havoc that it's created.
Now, her argument was that the district court should have held a hearing.
Well, my answer to that, Your Honor, is the district court did hold a hearing.
It did hold a hearing.
And there was an opportunity at that hearing for any lawyer to call any witness that it wanted to call. And there was no effort on behalf of Ms. Natarajan, who was at that point not yet appointed to represent HLF, to present any evidence that Mr. Alashi or Mr. Baker or anybody else could not authorize the appeal. And she has claimed, to Your Honors, that they cannot. And I do not think there is any evidence of that. To the contrary, the evidence supports the view that they can. And what we presented to the district court on remand was evidence that Mr. Baker and Mr. Alashi were the client contacts for Mr. Boyd, who is a partner at Friedman Boyd, up to and including almost the date of the remand hearing. Mr. Boyd testified that he had just a few days before that had a meeting or taken some action with respect to the Boehm litigation in which he represented HLF. HLF, this very same entity that wants to have an appeal without authorizing an appeal to this court. And it's the same law firm that was representing HLF before. So it rings hollow to say that these gentlemen could not authorize an appeal. And that is a cornerstone of HLF's argument to the court, that there was no one to authorize an appeal. In fact, there was. So let's come to the court's nunk-pro-tunk order appointing Ms. Natarajan. The court said that it was doing that in the interest of justice. But that is not sufficient. In fact, the case on which the government relies primarily in this respect is the FEC versus NRA case, which says that if a party is not authorized to file, in that case it was a petition for cert, at the time that it files that petition for cert in the Supreme Court, that the official who may authorize it cannot do so after the time for appeal has expired. If you take the court's nunk-pro-tunk order as the source of the authority, it came too late. It came far too late, because the time for filing a notice of appeal could not be more than the initial period of 10 days under the then existing rule plus 30 more. And that the court's nunk-pro-tunk order happened a year almost after the judgment was entered, almost a year. So that's way out of time under the FEC versus NRA rule. And I think I want to correct something. We say a few times in our brief that the court would lack jurisdiction. I concede it's not a jurisdictional question under Rule 4B, but once the government has invoked the rule and has claimed that the time limit was not complied with, it's mandatory and inflexible, and the court is required to dismiss the appeal. We talk in our brief about the next friend doctrine, and a way in which that is very relevant to Ms. Natarajan's argument is she claims that, well, nobody objected on behalf of HLF to her filing a notice of appeal, but that cannot be enough. By analogy to the next friend doctrine, it's not enough that a person who can't appeal on their own doesn't object. They have to be disabled from objecting, and HLF is not disabled from objecting. Furthermore, to claim that they don't object, it contains within it a logical flaw, because if at the same time you say there's nobody to authorize, it doesn't make sense to say, and nobody objected, because if somebody who was in a position to object objected, then that person is also in a position to authorize and has not. So that's logically doesn't go anywhere. Now, the court relied, as I said, on its inherent authority. But apart from the FEC versus NRA analysis, which says it's too late to exercise that authority, not apart from it, but related to it, the general law on exercising inherent authority is that a court cannot do that if it contradicts or contravenes a statute or a rule under the Carlisle and Bank of Nova Scotia line of cases. And what the court did served to eviscerate the time limits of Rule 4B, on filing a notice of appeal. So on that basis, on the ground that an inherent authority was exercised, the order also contains a flaw that should not be approved. Going back to what Your Honor said at the beginning about separating the time of the appeal from the time of the trial, there was nothing to have prevented Ms. Natarajan or any other lawyer who wished to provide pro bono services to HLF. And by the way, let me just say on that note, you had mentioned that OFAC had licensed it, and I believe that there's actually a regulation in place that provides a general license that a party can be represented in a criminal case by a lawyer and doesn't need to get particular authority to do that, but the lawyer doesn't need to ask permission from OFAC. In this case, Ms. Hollander did at the time of the trial, and OFAC said, yes, you know, no problem. You can't use HLF's money to pay for it, but Friedman Board was willing to do it pro bono, just as Ms. Natarajan is willing to do it pro bono. The bottom line on the inherent authority and the courts, district courts, to some degree understandable notion that it wanted to do what was seemed fair to it, is that it's not unfair, and it strikes the appropriate policy balance to require authorization from a client within the time limit for filing an appeal. There's nothing unfair about that. As I said, Ms. Natarajan could have sought permission, and there would have been a much better argument that Judge Solis at that point could have appointed her before the time for appeal had expired. But she did not do that. She simply filed her notice of appeal a day or two before the period expired, and there was never a request until later that she be appointed as counsel. And the last thing about that, the topic of the government's cross appeal, is that I think that that what has happened here is an example of one of the risks of allowing this, is that a lawyer who is a stranger to the proceedings, a stranger to the client, can come to this court and distort the facts and claim what HLF would have, how it would have defended itself at the trial, when those claims are at odds with the evidence in the case, completely at odds, which is another thing that Judge Solis found, that HLF could not have reasonably, given the evidence in the case, come into the trial court and said, my officers and my directors are on a frolic of their own. That was not something that the evidence would have supported. Which brings me to HLF's appeal that it has tried to bring to this court, which we contend ought to be dismissed. First of all, I want to speak for a little minute about the standard of review that I think the court needs to apply. Given the events that led to HLF being unrepresented by a lawyer in the trial court, this is invited error. At the time, during the voir dire, after voir dire had begun, after the government had several times brought to the court's attention that a waiver colloquy needed to be conducted, Mr. Elashi, on the advice of his lawyer, simply said, I'm not going to engage in the colloquy. And on the grounds that Mr. Klein himself was uncertain about Mr. Elashi's relationship to HLF or whether HLF even existed. And Friedman Boyd, which represented HLF at that point, not only did not object and say, well, just a moment, HLF is a litigant in this civil case and we represent it. So what is your basis for being uncertain about HLF's status as a corporation? And what is your basis for being uncertain about Mr. Elashi's relationship to it when he is our client contact? Instead of doing that, Friedman Boyd simply said, well, we will withdraw from representing HLF. And putting aside whether that should not have been allowed to happen at that moment, that is how it happened. And that, I contend, the court should review for invited error, in which case there has to be a manifest injustice before reversal would be ordered. And all of HLF's claims derive from its overarching claim that it was denied the right to counsel. So if you find that its lack of counsel was due to an invited error, then all of those other claims would fall as well. Speaking in terms of the argument that there's structural error, I contest that. It's not structural error, and even if it is, the Supreme Court's case law is of recent years very clear that in order to satisfy even a structural error case for reversal, there has to be, where it's not been preserved, there has to be a satisfaction of the plain error test. It may be that the structural error element would go to the third prong of the plain error test on whether prejudice has been established, and one would say, well, we're not going to go into whether prejudice has been established, we're just going to take that as a given. But the court still has to find both an error and an obvious error, and most importantly, in the circumstances of this case, the fourth prong of the plain error test, which is a strong prong and is not satisfied in the circumstances of this case. For all of the reasons that Judge Solis wrote about in his lengthy order on remand, about the fact that HLF's rights were very well protected and its interests were very well protected by the conduct of the trial on behalf of all the individual defendants, by their accomplished lawyers, and that there was nothing to that would put a divider between HLF's interests and these individuals' interests, or at least Mr. Elashi's and Mr. Baker's interests, and that they aligned perfectly, that they were the same defense, and that defense was presented to the jury. And it's so compelling to know that Judge Solis did not even realize that HLF was not represented by Friedman Boyd at the trial that he conducted, a 2 or 3 month trial, day in and day out, and he believes that HLF is represented by Friedman Boyd, and that's based on the conduct of the trial. So that finding is entitled to a great degree of deference from this court, and I see that my time is up. If there are not any questions, we would ask that the court dismiss HLF's appeal or, in the alternative, affirm its judgment.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Klein.
Your Honor, may I ask that a minute of my time be given to Mr. Baker's lawyer to address the search issue? It's not an Elashi issue because he didn't have standing.
Oh, that's fine.
So a minute, I'll turn over a minute at the end of my time. I want to focus on harmless error because that was what I took a good part of Mr. Palmer's argument to be focused on. And I want to say at the beginning that it always kind of astonishes me when the government fights tooth and nail of the district court to get evidence in, as it did in this case with Avi, with the Palestinian Authority documents, with the El Barassi documents, argues them vigorously to the jury, and then comes up on appeal and says it's all harmless, it didn't make any difference. It did make a difference in this case. Avi was an exceptionally powerful witness. He did weave it all together, these bits and pieces of evidence that were otherwise quite ambiguous and hard to tie into any particular narrative. These were hotly contested issues, as I outlined at the beginning of my argument. These Zakat committees were never listed. They aren't to this day. U.S. government entities did business with some of them right through the time that we're talking about. Mr. Abington, the Consul General of the United States, the chief United States representative in this area, came in, testified that he had visited those committees and did not consider them to be associated with Hamas. I mean, this was a hotly contested case. You can look at the first trial. You can look at the result of the first trial and see from that that this was a hotly contested case. There were 20 days of jury deliberation in the first case, 9 days in the second. These were hotly contested issues, and these the evidence that improperly was admitted made a substantial difference. I would also note a couple of things. One is the question isn't, as I think the government sort of implied in its argument, whether there was other evidence apart from the evidence that we question. The question, particularly for Avi, is whether, if you assume that the cross had its maximum potential and his credibility was destroyed, can you say that was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? So it doesn't matter if the evidence, if there was other evidence, or even if that evidence was sufficient to sustain a verdict. The question is, assuming that cross had its maximum effect, was it harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? And I don't think on this record you can say that about Avi. I'd also note, and this, Judge King, is something that you asked a question about, virtually all of the evidence that the government cited as its other evidence was pre-1995. The Philadelphia meeting was October 1993. This closed-door meeting that Shrivaji testified about was...
Next thing that happens is the alarm goes off and we all have to leave.
All right, I'll be ready.
That'll be good.
That was October 1994. The El Barassi and the Ashgar documents were all pre-designation, pre-1995. What was lacking for the government was evidence that post-1995, the Zakat committees were controlled by Hamas and the defendants knew that they were controlled by Hamas. And Avi, of course, filled in that gap, relying on the pre-95 evidence, but relying also on his own expertise. I'd also note that a lot of the evidence on which the government relies for its other evidence is evidence that we challenge. And that goes to this question of cumulative error. And I really urge the court not to atomize the error here, but to look at it as a whole. Look at this record as a whole and ask whether this was a fair trial. And I think the answer is it was not. It was not a fair trial. There were many errors, and whether each one individually would have affected the verdict is kind of beside the point. The entire trial process here was so riddled with error of so many different kinds that the process was not fair. I want to make two more quick points before I turn it over to Mr. Baker's lawyer. The first is, I thought I heard government counsel say that the El Barassi documents were formal records of the Palestine Committee. Well, first of all, there was no foundational testimony for those documents whatsoever. The only evidence was that they were found in Mr. El Barassi's home. And El Barassi 20, may I have another minute?
Yeah.
A few seconds. El Barassi 22 in particular, which was the key document, is a handwritten document. I urge you to look at it. And yes, it says Dear Shukri, but it doesn't say Dear Shukri Baker or anything more. There's no evidence. It could have said Dear John. That wouldn't mean that it was written to me. It's just a handwritten document with no provenance whatsoever. Last thing I want to say is there are issues that have been raised on behalf of individual appellants here that have not been argued, and I simply don't want those to get lost in the talk of the combination. There's the First Amendment issue for Mr. Abdul Qadir, which I think is very important, a double jeopardy issue for Mr. Alashi, and there are other issues as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And may I introduce Ms. Terry Duncan, who's the counsel for Mr. Baker.
Yes, I recognize her name.
May it please the court. We're not arguing that the independent source doctrine always requires that the property return to private hands in order for that doctrine to apply. What we're arguing in this case is that there was nothing independent about the warrant that the government obtained 4 months after conducting the illegal search of the Holy Land offices. So when you look at the state of the case of Murray, in that case, the officer made an illegal entry and search of a warehouse. He touched nothing, left the warehouse, and then they secured it and got a warrant and came back and conducted a search. And the Supreme Court held that that warrant was independent source of the evidence. In this case, a better analogy would be as if the officer had gone into the warehouse, as in Murray, had not only seen the bales of marijuana, but had then seized them, taken them to the police station, sat there for 4 months, and then obtained a warrant, and argued that that warrant was an independent source. What the government is essentially arguing is that law enforcement can go in at any time that they think they have probable cause, search and seize property, so long as at some point in the future they go in and get a warrant and don't rely on anything that they saw during that initial warrantless search or seizure. And that simply is not the law.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see, Mr. Dratel.
Thank you, Your Honor. The district court's opinion does not talk about facts. It really just talks about that willfully element and a distinction that it draws between counts 1 and 11, which is an illusory distinction because it's an element for both conspiracies, willfully. I've gone over that. And elements are elements. You cannot find a conspiracy without finding willful conduct. With respect to summations and argument, the reason willfully was argued is because it encompassed all those conspiracies. It was not just limited. There's nothing in the argument by either the government or the defense that says willfully only applies to count 11 and doesn't apply to count 1 as well, because it did apply to both. And in my summation, on behalf of Mr. Elmazain, I spent a substantial amount of time, probably more time, speaking about the Zakat committees and how they were not connected to Hamas and that the government had not proved that, in fact, they were operating under the control or benefit of Hamas, which is a separate set of facts that was found against the government by the jury and all those other counts, including counts 2 through 10, which are material support counts, that cannot be relitigated by the government in count 1 regardless. With respect to the government's position in terms of facts, in terms of how this case was tried, in terms of the congruence of facts to each conspiracy, look at, and we cite two passages, page 44 of our brief, where the government is in response to the severance motion that we made before the second trial. And it does not make any distinction between the evidence and the facts used. They lump all the conspiracies together because that's the government's theory, and that's the way the case was tried. And this is not about hypothetical, what the jury might have done, and we can't look at that deadlocked count, even though we may want to ask why. But the Supreme Court has said over and over again, this is a practical, real-world inquiry. And in the practical, real-world nature of this case and how it was tried, the jury could not have acquitted Mr. Elmazain of being a conspirator from 1995 to 2004, which is the scope of the IEPA Count 11 conspiracy, could not have acquitted him, and somehow that the government could, and somehow not have, that the government could somehow prove he was a conspirator, rather, between 97 and 2004, a shorter time frame with the exact same evidence and essentially the exact same conspiracy, according to the way the government tried the case. If you look at this record and the way that, and all the factors that the courts have, and this court has used in comparing evidence, not elements. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, to respond to briefly to three of the government's points on its cross-appeal. The government's cross-appeal seems to come down to the question of why did Mr. Elashi say nothing about the appeal if he wanted it to go forward? And I think the answer is because since 2007, he thought on advice of counsel he couldn't say anything on behalf of HLF anymore. Whether that was right or wrong, the district court faced the same conundrum on appeal that it did at the trial level, which was what to do about the fact that HLF either could or could not appeal. Now, we suggested the trustee procedure to the district court. Unfortunately, the district court made no mention of it in its order. We inquired to the district court about it after the order came out, and the district court said it felt it was unnecessary because I would represent the best interests of HLF, and there was no evidence to prove otherwise. Unfortunately, there was nothing that I could appeal about that, and My record had already been made that the trustee procedure was the preferable one. And I think that The bottom line question has to be, if the appeal is not allowed on technical grounds, and I do think this is a technicality because Rule 4B was satisfied, the time limit was satisfied, and the question is, the only question is this authorization question, and I think it's a technicality. If the court believes that either the...
Now, let me just say one thing about that. It's not a technicality. It may be that you're right about the merits, or maybe not, but it's not a technicality.
Your Honor, I completely agree that in every other case, this is a very important question, and I take it very seriously. But what I mean by technicality is it's an extremely difficult position to be put in, to be told that there is nobody for the client who opposes an appeal but who can authorize an appeal to suggest a procedure to the district court that would be followed for any other corporation. If this were the United Way, if this were Colgate-Palmolive, there are disinterested board members out there. There are other stakeholders out there. The court would, this can't be the rule for all corporations that they come to court and get convicted and forfeited their assets in absentia and without counsel. So I would leave the court with this final point, which is that the motion to appoint counsel was originally made before this court. That was remanded to the district court. So that motion is part of this appeal. And if the court so chooses, it could still order a trustee to be appointed. And moreover, the court could treat this as a matter of equity because of the in absentia and trial without counsel. It could equitably excuse the requirement for authorization or find some other equitable solution. Thank you very much.
Thank you. One thing I wanted to say, because all lawyers are here, many of them are, I suspect there's a squad somewhere else too. The briefs in this case from all parties are world class, every last one of them. It's a really wonderful brief, and we are very much indebted to you for that. We thank you. And this morning has been excellent, and we thank you for that as well. Court will be in recess under the usual order.